Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drance live from the Kintech Studio. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line, Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and reno warriors for over 50 years. Visit them at one of their three locations to serve you or online at dunbarlumber.com. JanPro, from warehouses to washrooms and everywhere in between, JanPro keeps workplaces tidy, clean, and disinfected. For a free quote, visit janpro.ca. Canucks game day coming up in just 3 hours here, 4:30 start time against the Capitals. Sat and Dan will be on Canucks Central immediately following our show and then leading in to the pregame show. So we got a lot to get into here in the final segment. Let's go to the whiteboard.
All right, now, fellas, hey, let's focus up, huh?
It is your daily deep dive into what's up with the Canucks for today, January 8th. The headline is the Canucks are playing Alex Ovechkin and the Washington Capitals tonight in Washington. And we've barely mentioned this, and I feel like partly it's that, you know, what else is there to say about it other than it's awesome? But, I mean, they're playing the Capitals. Alex Ovechkin is 22 goals from tying Wayne Gretzky's career mark of 894 goals in the NHL. Any way you slice it, that is a massive storyline and a massive headline when the Canucks are matching up an all-time great chasing that mark in history.
Well, and looking increasingly like a lineman who plays in the NFC North and came back from injury, a really severe injury, and immediately got back to lighting it up, just further reinforcing his Russian machine never breaks legacy here. Yeah, I mean, look, Ovechkin's not the most dangerous thing on the Caps anymore, right? Like, he's still a skilled goal scorer, but he's not what kills you when you play the Caps. But the fact that he's still able to score goals and hold down a power play and demand the sort of attention that he does at his age, I mean, nothing short of incredible. We'll never see his like again.
Yeah, and just at this point, you know, he's one of those players where when the Canucks are lining up against him, it's a special opportunity to watch this guy for Canucks fans in NHL action as he chases history. And just to put it in perspective, you know, he's probably, I don't want to jinx anything, but he's probably going to not just break the record, but be the first guy to crest 900 goals in his NHL career. That 900 goals would be 20 consecutive 45-goal seasons. So just to put that in a little bit of perspective, 20 consecutive 45-goal seasons. Imagine a guy comes up at 20 and scores 45 goals. It's like, now do that every year until you're 40 and you'll tie Alex Ovechkin. That's what we're talking about here.
Yeah.
Just a preposterous accomplishment.
I mean, yeah. And he did so much of it, you know, like I'm shoehorning something that I just want to talk about anyway, Jamie, into this, but he did it in an era where goalies were stopping 915, 920. You know, Rick Tocchet had some commentary about it being easier to score or easier to get to the front of the net now than it used to be. But it was so much harder to beat goaltenders, right, than it had been certainly in the 80s for most of Ovechkin's career. And, you know, one thing about Ovechkin, right, you put him in that spot on the power play, right, and Adam Oates did anyway. And, you know, then Adam Oates on Tocchet's staff did it again with Stamkos. And then you had like Tyler Seguin. And now that, you know, flanker shot on the 1-3-1, like that's part of what we're seeing. Part of what we're seeing is more skill on fourth lines. Part of what we're seeing is more puck moving up and down lineups, different emphasis in terms of skill that's in the lineup. And part of it's just individual skills development. But like right now, we are in this era where like the NHL announced or released a bunch of their stats at midseason that really reinforced, you know, my longstanding agenda that the NHL is becoming more like the NBA, right? Where so 6.1 goals per game, fourth straight season at more than six, and it's the second longest stretch in NHL history of six plus goals per game. 44% of games have comeback wins. Talk about NBA style hockey.
44%.
Right? Second highest.
Wow.
Second highest rate in NHL history. Now, this is context because when we're talking about like the Canucks are blowing leads, they never blew leads last year. Like, this is happening everywhere. The problem is not that the Canucks can't hold leads. The problem is that the Canucks are getting outshot too often. The problem is that the Canucks star players aren't winning enough games for them. Because in this environment, because here's the other part of it, league-wide save percentage, lowest since 2005-06, it's at exactly 900. Chance to finish sub-900 for the first time, you know, basically since the advent of the butterfly. It's the third lowest in 30 years. 30 years. And so what are we talking about? We're talking about a league with swingier results, more volatile save percentage, meaning higher conversion rates, which means that there is less randomness dictating outcomes. Star players have a larger impact on games. Teams struggle to hold leads because it's harder to defend shooting. Now, we're not in a... The question should not be framed as like, goaltending is not good. This should... It should be framed as we have entered a golden era of finishing skill in the NHL. And it's not just... You know, the revolutionary impact of the Matthews drag shot. It's also the way players, and JT Miller is one of the best at this in the league, use layered traffic and wait for layered traffic, and the way that screeners have developed to be even better in terms of, you know, managing traffic and taking goaltenders' eyes and making goaltenders helpless. The way that the, you know, implementation of post-integration techniques and on across goaltenders, sort of the playing the probabilities stuff with goaltenders, the way that players adjusted to attacking them on transitions. Guys like Macklin Celebrini are like, they have it down. They've grown up doing it against goaltenders who play advanced techniques, and you can tell when you watch them play. It's like a second nature to them. It's not even something they had to learn. The new generation of guys didn't even have to learn it the way guys like Quinn Hughes spent years studying to become better finishers had to. And it's not like Quinn Hughes is old, right? You're already seeing like 5 years behind Quinn Hughes. You're seeing a new level of mental acuity in terms of an awareness of how to attack goalies. So this is, I mean, for now, like, look, all of these things are a pendulum. We're going to see goaltenders fight back in this battle. But we're in a golden era of NHL finishing. And that has massive ramifications for how we should view the game and how we should view this Canucks team. Because, look, Vancouver Shooters did a phenomenal job and have still done a phenomenal job punching above their weight. You still need to be able to control games to a certain baseline. And too often, this Canucks team has fallen beneath that baseline this season, which is absolutely part of their problem. But the issue tends not to be that this Canucks team is failing to hold leads. The problem is more often tended to be that they're not extending them, in part because their star players, some of the guys who keep coming up in trade rumors, haven't been the guys winning them games, like, period. And so I just wanted to bring all of this up in the context of, you know, the fact that Ovechkin did so much of his goal scoring, is the most prolific goal scorer ever in a golden age of goaltenders, only adds to the aura of the accomplishment that he, you know, has a chance to set this season. But I also think it's worth noting how the game has now changed a bit, maybe permitting him to get over the finish line, you know, but also changes how I think we need to regard the game itself and what it means for this Canucks team.
And not to get too off the point here and off the headlines, but Brandon in Vancouver texts in, would that mean if you had good goaltending or defense, it's a relatively stronger competitive advantage if you have it? And I mean, I look what Connor, I don't know, like, I guess for goaltending, you pretty much look at, you know, the gap between what your goalie's doing and the league average save percentage. But I do think you look at Connor Hellebuyck and what he's doing in Winnipeg. He has a 926 save percentage. Like, 926 save percentage.
Ludicrous.
That was elite 15 years ago, right? When save percentage was way, way up. Still, if you were a workhorse of a 926, that was incredible. Doing it now, I do think there's an element where we maybe haven't fully computed just how outrageous that is and just what an advantage it is for Winnipeg that he's able to keep up that level.
Well, just like Dominic Hasek has talked about in the company of Martin Brodeur and Patrick Roy, when he should be talked about in the company of Wayne Gretzky and Mario Lemieux, right? Like, the ability to save that many goals above average, right? It is, I mean, that makes you one of the single most valuable players in hockey. But of course, you know, if we were to consider goalies, like, I always say this, every time I'm filling out my MVP ballot and start to consider a goaltender, I go, well, if I applied this rubric, right, quantitatively, my whole ballot would be goaltenders. So I need to either exclude them or really raise the bar. But yeah, Hellebuyck Without question. Look, it does place an additional premium on defense. It's harder to defend these guys. It's harder to defend shooters in this golden era. And that does, you know, make what Vancouver has still been able to accomplish defensively that much more impressive. But like, this is why I think we're in a moment in time where we need to rethink the idea of hockey as like a weak link sport where like the best third line is going to win every third playoff series. And where we go into the playoffs and we say things like, well, defense wins championships. It still matters. You need to have a certain baseline, but we're about to enter like a third straight year where, you know, Vegas won with offense, right? Florida and Edmonton won as the teams that generated shots the most reliably. That is the fundamental thing you need to do. And that's the fundamental area that this Canucks team has struggled in massively all season with. So whether they get their house in order or not, right, that's still the level that they have to, you know, it's not getting back to what we saw earlier in the season. It's like they need to hit a level that they haven't hit, not even just this year, but last year, if they're actually going to contend here. There's distance to travel.
They need to hit it and they need to sustain it for a long stretch too. So it's
and they need to beat it.
Yeah, it's a big
like
task.
They need to hit a level they've never hit, period.
Anyway. A couple other quick headlines here. We touched on these earlier on in the show, but in particular, just want to mention that the Young Stars Tournament will not be returning to Penticton next year. The Canucks announced yesterday a new two-year partnership with the Seattle Kraken. They'll stage a couple of games, prospect games against each other next year in Seattle, the year after that in Abbotsford. And Jim Rutherford, Canucks president of hockey operations, said in a statement that it was other teams, they weren't able to secure commitments from other teams to continue the Young Stars in Penticton. As you said earlier in the show, Drance, they love that tournament. It works really, really well for them. It's a great event. Unfortunate that the other Western Canadian teams not fully committed to it. It's gone away in the past. It's come back. Hopefully it comes back sooner rather than later, because it is an awesome event, not just for the fans in Penticton, but for the Canucks, for their players, for their staff as well. So that's the update there. And again, a two-year partnership with Seattle to stage prospect games between the two teams. As I mentioned to Bukla as well, Elias Pettersson, defenseman with the Abbotsford Canucks, named an AHL All-Star in his first full AHL season. So congrats to him on getting the nod from the Abbotsford Canucks.
And congrats to all of center Elias Pettersson's haters on the easy joke.
Yes.
I told you he was an AHL All-Star.
There's been a lot of easy material to work with flying around related to the Canucks recently.
You're right.
A lot.
We are not digging.
No.
Unfortunately, like the Canucks on too many nights this season, we are not exactly digging deep.
No, there's a lot of low-hanging fruit at the moment. All right, on to the broadsheet. Speaking of low-hanging fruit, on to the broadsheet and the incredible volume of rumors and reports out there on, yes, Miller and Pettersson, but also some other interesting tidbits. And let's start with one of those other tidbits, which is from your Athletic colleague, Pierre LeBrun, who included a note on Rick Tocchet and basically said that, yes, the team has an option, but it's really more of a mutual option on Rick Tocchet's contract beyond this year. So he controls his fate to a degree. Now, is it possible that the Canucks would be, you know, proactive and say, you know what, we're going in a different direction, best of luck to you, I guess. But really, it comes down to Rick Tocchet doesn't have to be here. He can become a coaching free agent if he wants. And we talked about this earlier in the crossover. I have no specific reason to think that that's his plan or anything like that. But I think it's worth noting. We've tended to frame the conversation around, well, are the Canucks going to give him an extension? But this is a two-way street. Both parties have agency here. And I think that needs to be considered, too, Rick Tocchet's perspective on this.
Yeah, so I don't know exactly how it's structured, and I'll make some calls on it in the weeks ahead here. But the Bruce Boudreau contract, remember when we were covering the will they or won't they a couple years back, also had that mutual option locked in. Now, I think we knew that Boudreau was kind of out of favor, even though he'd had that stunning success after taking over in that first year in Vancouver. But the way it played out, like, the team informed him that they were going to exercise their option first. And then remember, he had to like June 1. To exercise his, like, his came at a later date, and the way that his worked anyway, there was sort of a payment that the Canucks sort of took off the table by declaring that they were going to keep him. If they'd walked, there was some compensation that Boudreau would have got with his walking papers that was then removed off the table once the Canucks decided that they. So I wonder if this works with a similar mechanism. That was sort of one thought that I'd had, because certainly the Boudreau one played out where it really became a pretty interesting staring contest with the Canucks applying a fair bit of pressure as Boudreau kind of, I think, wanted to anyways, cool his jets, gather as much information on various openings before, declaring his intent to return. Ultimately, he did so a little bit more proactively than I think was ideal for him. And obviously that didn't work out for either party involved as it stood. We'll see where this goes. You know, there's been a lot of chatter about Rick Tocchet's future, like dating back to the summer when, you know, it was coming to me and I was completely writing it off. I was like, that's ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll sort of see where this goes. But interesting scoop from Pierre LeBrun, just a cherry on top of the latest, you know, Miller-Pettersson Sunday. Miller-Pettersson rumor Sunday.
Yes.
That we've been, you know, basically like eating like elementary school children for weeks here.
Yeah, and now throw the Tocchet, the coach, in on top of it as well. Top two centers, yep. And now the coach involved too.
And how long until Brock Besser becomes a local talking point?
Well, like the only reason it's not is because of the Miller and the Pettersson situation. Otherwise, it would be the number one talking point. I mean, I think we opened the season and how naive we were, but I even made the comment of like, what's going to be the big rumor talking point this year now that Pettersson's off the table because he signed an extension? And again, how naive I was, but I thought it was going to be Besser's deal, right? Is this going to get it done? And instead, it's really fallen off the front burner or off the front pages. But it's an important situation, and I this touches on something else I want to get into, so I'll just run through quickly some of the reporting around Miller and Pettersson from yesterday, because it was a very busy day in that regard, and from today I should say as well. So Elliot Friedman in his 32 Thoughts column confirming that the Canucks and Rangers had talks about a Miller-Zibanejad swap, now also noted that it was a bigger deal than just that, says Vancouver covets Braden Schneider, a name we've heard a lot in connection with the Canucks, but also that the Rangers don't want to trade Braden Schneider. Chris Johnston reporting the Canucks are serious about considering trading Pettersson. Conversations on both players remain ongoing. Pierre LeBrun says the Canucks are listening on both players. They've told teams they're not interested in futures, would need an apples for apples type transaction, and also that the Canucks value both players very highly. So this is kind of where I get confused here, because if you are the idea of we really want to trade these players and we value them very highly, so we would need a like for like deal. Those things don't square to me. Like, if you want to trade the player, by definition, you're kind of accepting you're not going to get as talented a player back, and you're doing it because you want to change the direction of the team in some way. You know, how often do you see superstar players traded for each other in these kind of one-to-one situations? It's very, very rare, in particular in season. So on the one hand, you keep getting these reports that they're very serious about it. You know, they're listening. They're seeing what the market is. This is not just a smokescreen. It's not just about sending message. They're serious. But on the other hand, the idea that, well, they value them so highly and they need like for like, they don't want to do futures. It reminds me a little bit of like a boyfriend and a girlfriend, right? And the boyfriend's like, I will propose to you, I swear, but only once I get that next promotion. You know what I mean? Like, you're setting all these parameters on doing it such that you will never actually do it because you don't actually want to do it. And that's kind of what I feel like. As much as we're getting this reporting about how serious they are, all of the other behavior seems to indicate, or all the other reporting seems to indicate, that they're setting the price or the parameters in such a way that it's never going to materialize.
Right. Like, who has the cap space to eat one of those contracts and a like player and the desire to change their mix?
To trade their like player. You would be excited about that like player coming in.
And at least with Pettersson, you could look at it as like a multi-year thing. Like with Miller, you've got to kind of strike now or next year, right? You've kind of got to look at those as the years in which you feel pretty confident that he's going to be worth the $8 million. And thereafter, you know, just because of age, it gets a little dicier. He might be able to age in a way where, like, I think he'll retain his effectiveness on the power play. But if you're viewing him as like a first line matchup centerman with this you know, nasty streak and the 5-on-5 defense, like that all becomes a little bit more touch and go as guys age, at least from a risk perspective. So, you know, yeah, you're right. This is super limiting. And I mean, I wrote an article with Arthur Staple over at The Athletic about like, what would a JT Miller to the New York Rangers trade look like? And, you know, I mean, our conclusion fundamentally is there's a reason these things keep happening, because obviously Drury, I think, likes the player, right? There's a reason we're having this conversation for the third time in 4 years, but there's also a reason it hasn't ever happened. And it's that the fit is almost impossible to figure out between these two teams. And I think that can, like, I think if you did this exercise with just about every team, like the three that sort of stand out to me, I mean, I saw Elliot Friedman linking Columbus and Vancouver, and I think that makes sense. Detroit, especially if you're talking Pedersen, right? Then I mean, I think you can pretty easily begin to carve out a fit. They have sort of a surplus of, you know, whether it's like Marco Kasper for the young guy, Michael Rasmussen for the mid-age guy, or Andrew Kopp for the older guy. They've got a lot of prospects. I mean, that's a team that you can like actually make it work with. You know, and maybe Boston if it's Miller, but not if it's Pedersen. And it's like, that's kind of it. It's going to take an awful lot of creativity and an awful lot of will to change their mix from the Canucks, it seems, to get this done.
All right, I'll run through the rest of the whiteboard in quick succession here. Quick lineup notes. Lankinen starts tonight. Demko is close. Per Tocket, Pedersen, and Forbort, both game-time decisions. Also, as we mentioned earlier, Filip Hronek is signed to Abbotsford on a conditioning loan. Playoff and standings update. Canucks holding steady. Of course, they didn't play last night, so their odds did tick up slightly to a 74% chance to make the playoffs. But I do want to note that as people have been pointing out to us on social media, Dom's model much higher than some of the other public models out there on the Canucks' chances of making the playoffs. So we're citing that one, but if you, for whatever reason, prefer the other ones, there's some more pessimistic reads out there as well. And finish up with the betting update for us, Dranser.
Canucks plus 150 road dogs in Washington tonight. Washington minus 180 on the money line. That's about a two-thirds probability of victory for the Capitals at home. The total is set at 5.5, kind of like the over. Look, you're right. The Dom's model is higher, generally speaking, on sort of where the Canucks are at in terms of making the playoffs. And I think that's best captured by the fact that they're to make the playoff odds have dipped steadily across the course of the last 6 weeks. I mean, they were up to minus 400 at one point. Today, on average, you can find them at minus 180 or minus 185, depending on the book. And, you know, that's, again, a two-thirds probability of making the playoffs, not the lock that they seemed as recently as a month ago.
All right, that's the whiteboard. That's the show for today. Thanks for listening. Sat and Dan coming up next on Canucks Central, and then they'll have the pregame show as well. It's the Canucks and the Capitals later on. We'll be back tomorrow here on Sportsnet 650.